We've always been very bad at predicting the future. Don't believe me? Well, 67 years ago, the ABC asked Australians to do just that, and...
You all commute daily and hourly so fast through space in your private flying saucers.
Global peace and international harmony will be completely attained by the year 2000.
Yeah, still waiting on that world peace. I'm Matt Bevan, and from if you're listening, this is Black Swans, a series about the events we can't see coming, no matter how hard we try. It's available now on ABC Listen.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The September 11 terrorist attack on New York City is one of the most infamous events in history. The footage of those attacks is seared into our collective memory, and it's against this backdrop that today's story plays out. Because what you might not know is that just a few months earlier, the world was warned that a major terrorist attack was imminent. It's April 2001. We're in Paris. A bearded Afghan military commander and resistance leader stands before European Parliament. He's in his 40s, neat, fluent in French. His voice is steady and his message is clear. The Taliban and Al-Qaeda are planning something big, he warns the crowd. They will not stop with Afghanistan. The world must be ready. The audience nods politely. A few take notes. Most seem to dismiss him. Just another warlord from a far-off country. What could he know that they didn't? But Ahmed Shah Massoud did know. He'd watched the networks of fighters and financiers spread across his borders. He'd seen what Al-Qaeda could do, and he knew Osama bin Laden was deadly serious. He returns home from Paris, back to his valley stronghold in the north of Afghanistan, to a place called Banjashir. He's uneasy, frustrated that his warnings have not been heeded. He knows something terrible is coming. He knows the cost will be enormous. Why won't anyone take him seriously? Fast forward a few months. It's September 9th, 2001. Two men arrive at one of Ahmed Shah Massoud's military bases, carrying Belgian passports and a television camera. They're journalists, nothing Massoud isn't accustomed to. And so, he agrees to an interview. Massoud understands the power of the media. He's smart, well-read, and articulate. In fact, he's fluent in five languages and is friends with the French philosopher Bernard-Henri Lévy. In the niche world of Afghan politics, Ahmed Shah Massoud is as close as you can get to a celebrity. But of course, this isn't your run-of-the-mill interview. This is a moment before the course of world history changes forever. Hello, my friend. I'm Aslan Pahari, and this is Assassin. The show where we tell the stories of the world's most shocking assassinations. And today, a man sometimes referred to as the Che Guevara of Afghanistan, Ahmed Shah Massoud. But this shorthand undersells the legacy of an iconic guerrilla leader who fought against both the Soviet Union and the Taliban from his fortress in Banjashir. A man who warned the world of 9/11 and was assassinated by the same people who perpetrated those attacks just days before they played out. But who was the one they called the Lion of Banjashir? And how did his assassins bring him down when so many others had tried before? Ahmed Shah Massoud's story begins at the bottom of a narrow gorge in the Hindu Kush, the ancient valley of Banjashir. Steep cliffs, stone villages, fast rivers. The valley sits roughly 150 kilometers north of Kabul along rough roads. Winters lock it down in ice. In spring, orchards and fields blossom. The people are mostly ethnically Tajik, Persian-speaking mountain folk, proud and fiercely independent. It's here, in 1953, that Ahmed Shah Massoud is born. His father was an Afghan army officer, strict and well-respected. But Masood's a little different. Quiet, serious, always with a book. He loves poetry. He studies religion. He's also a really good footballer. In the early 1970s, Masood leaves Panjshir for the big smoke, Kabul, to study engineering. He arrives in a modern city where girls attend school and women appear in public life. And he sees a political situation that convinces him that power in Kabul is crushing local autonomy and faith. And therein lies the root of Masood's paradox. He can support women's education and rule of law and still plot to topple governments for religious reasons. Masood joins the Muslim Youth Organization and is influenced by Muslim Brotherhood-style ideas, moral reform, social justice, anti-communism, and clean governance. He's a disciplined organizer who believes Afghan society can be both Islamic and educated. School for boys and girls, courts that restrain predators, leaders that are answerable to the law. During Masood's time studying in Kabul, a king rules Afghanistan, Muhammad Zahir Shah. But not for long. In 1973, Daud Khan launches a coup which ends the monarchy. Daud is the king's cousin, and he pulls off the coup while the king is overseas, all of which makes it feel more like a family prank than a military coup. Anyway, the freshly minted President Daud accuses the former monarchy of being corrupt and stagnant. He proclaims a republic and promises progress, but falls short. As we hear on the show time and time again, power corrupts. Daud jails opponents, especially Islamist opponents, and brings the government, military and judiciary all under his personal control. To Masood, this is the antithesis of accountable rule. So he and other student Islamists like Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, more about him later, launch a counter-coup against the new president. But the coup fails and Masood flees to Pakistan. However, it turns out that exile is good for him. It's where he studies guerrilla warfare. He learns to build small units. He masters traps and ambushes. He learns to sabotage infrastructure and supply lines, and he builds personal relationships. These matter as much as guns in the land of Afghanistan. Relations with village elders, mullahs, and traders will prove crucial for Masood. And then he prepares for battle. It's 1978, and the communists seize Kabul. Over the next year, the Soviet Red Army rolls in with tanks, helicopters, and whole divisions of troops. This is the signal for Masood to return home and put everything he learned in exile into practice against the Soviets. Now, to understand why Masood's newfound expertise in guerrilla warfare would prove to be so crucial, you need to understand a bit about the geography of Panjshir. Panjshir lies close to the Salang Corridor, a highway and tunnel system that links Soviet Central Asia in the north to Kabul and Bagram in the south. It's the main artery for fuel, ammunition, and troop rotations. In other words, it's a key strategic location. From Panjshir's steep valleys and high ground, a disciplined force can cut, bleed, and harass convoys, then melt away. This harsh terrain is Masood's fortress, and the logistics map is his chief ally. He builds a well-organized army within the Panjshir Valley, dividing it into defensive commands and mobile companies. But the Soviets don't retreat. They faced opposition like this many times before. Masood might be outnumbered and outgunned, but he won't be outsmarted. Not here. He has a secret weapon. These mountains, is valleys he knows so well. Mines on the roads, ambushes in the valleys, snipers in the cliffs. Bunjashir is both a shield and a dagger. It protects his soldiers and allows them to strike the Soviets' most crucial supply lines. The Red Army launches 9 major offensives into Bunjashir, and 9 times Massoud's fighters repel them. The Soviets call him a ghost. Time and again, he pulls off military victories against impossible odds. His people name him the Lion of Bunjashir. After almost a decade of fighting, the Soviets give up, and by 1989, the last of their military withdraws. Massoud and his people celebrate. Now is the time to rebuild. But that's not what happens. The Soviets leave a power vacuum behind them. And around the same time, Massoud's role begins to change. No longer just a guerrilla commander, he steps into politics. He wants a new Afghanistan. Unlike other warlords, Massoud doesn't just seize land or loot the treasury. He pushes to create a coalition government that represents all of Afghanistan's peoples. Ethnic Tajiks like himself, but also Pashtuns, Uzbeks, Hazaras. But not everyone shares that dream. When Kabul falls to the Mujahideen in 1992, Massoud enters the city as the new defense minister. It's the first time he's held official political power. But the Mujahideen, once united against the Red Army, fractures into rival factions. And the new defense minister, Ahmad Shah Massoud, the man who once held the Bunjashir Valley against 9 Soviet offensives, finds himself in the middle of a political storm. Around this time, an old rival re-enters the picture, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. Hekmatyar is a radical commander backed by Pakistan. Both men had started off in the same Muslim youth organization, but they couldn't have been more different. In religion, Massoud was a moderate, willing to work with non-Islamic groups, while Hekmatyar was far more hardline. Personality-wise, Massoud was soft-spoken and charismatic, while Hekmatyar was ruthless and aggressive. The pair had once studied together in Kabul, but now Hekmatyar unleashes a storm of rockets onto the same city. While Massoud defends the capital, Hekmatyar seems intent on burning it down. The city becomes a battlefield. Markets, schools, hospitals, all are targets. Rockets rain down on neighborhoods. Families abandon their homes or are killed. The civil war scars Kabul beyond recognition. Scars it still bears today. This chaos opens the door for a new force offering calm and order after years of civil war, the Taliban. Rising from the madrasas of Pakistan, trained and armed by Islamabad's intelligence services and funded by wealthy Gulf donors, the Taliban sweep through Afghanistan. In 1996, they seize the capital. But this success comes at a cost. A new era of harsh theocracy begins. The Taliban's arrival forces Massoud to retreat north. His army bloodied, his influence reduced, his territory shrinking. But he has a plan to hold the Taliban at bay. Massoud forms the Northern Alliance, a coalition of Tajiks, Uzbeks under General Dostum, and Hazaras led by Karim Khalili. Together, they fortify the northeast of the country, a last bastion of resistance against the Taliban. But the Taliban has support beyond their borders, backing from Pakistan, from Saudi Arabia, from foreign jihadist groups, including Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda. Indeed, Al-Qaeda gives the Taliban money, men, and firepower. In return, the Taliban offer bin Laden a safe base. It dawns on Massoud that something bigger is at play. Something that stretches beyond his country's borders. He sends envoys to Europe, to the UN, to anyone who will listen. They warn that Al-Qaeda is using Afghan soil to prepare attacks far beyond these mountains. The world nods politely and then looks away. These warnings that fall on deaf ears put a massive target on Massoud's back. A plot starts forming against him. September 9th, 2001. The air in Khwaja Bahuddin, a remote town in Afghanistan's northeast, is heavy with dust and late summer heat. Inside the resistance compound, Ahmed Shah Massoud is at work. His commanders shuffle in and out with reports. Taliban troop movements, rumors of foreign fighters crossing the border, warnings from the front. Massoud listens quietly, stroking his beard. His eyes are tired but unblinking. 2 decades of war have carved lines into his face, but his presence is calm, almost regal. 2 men arrive at the gate. Their papers say they're Belgian journalists making a documentary about Afghan resistance. They're carrying a heavy television camera and a bag of equipment. The guards search them carefully and find nothing suspicious. And so, they're welcomed into the compound and are led to a small, dimly lit room for the interview. Massoud takes a seat alongside his aides while the men set up their camera. Cables snake across the floor. The reporters open with a few polite questions. They ask about the war, about the Taliban, about Massoud's vision for the future of Afghanistan. Massoud answers steadily, as always. His words are calm, but carry a sense of urgency. And then, in an instant, everything changes. A click, a blinding flash, and the camera explodes. The blast rips through the room like thunder. Shards of metal and plastic slice the air. Flames erupt, the walls shake. Massoud is thrown backwards, blood rushing from the deep wounds in his chest and face. His aides collapse around him. The journalists are shredded by their own bomb. Guards burst in, coughing. Blinded, they drag Massoud's limp body through the haze. His clothes already soaked in blood. Outside, people panic. Massoud is rushed to a helicopter. This is the fastest way to get him to hospital. But the Lion of Panjshir, invincible for so long, dies en route. For his followers, news of Massoud's assassination is unbearable. Their commander, their lion, murdered before their eyes. In Panjshir, men and women weep openly in the streets. In the resistance stronghold, shock turns to rage. Across Afghanistan, the silence of disbelief settles like dust after a storm. The Lion of Panjshir had fought the Soviets. He had defied Pakistan. He had held the line against the Taliban. But in the end, he was killed not on the battlefield, but in a chair by a bomb hidden inside a camera. Al-Qaeda sent the assassins on the orders of Osama bin Laden himself, and the timing was no coincidence. By killing Massoud, Al-Qaeda cleared the path for their Taliban allies. 2 days later, on September 11th, another Osama bin Laden order plays out, and the world finally understands the urgency of Massoud's warning. Massoud's story doesn't end with his assassination. 2 days later, the United States is at war. When American boots first touch Afghan soil, they don't stand alone. They're guided, protected, and carried by Massoud's fighters, the Northern Alliance. Even in death, the Lion of Panjshir shapes the battlefield. Assassins is hosted by me, Aslan Pahari. Hannah Jose is the producer. Sound by John Jacobs. Kyla Slaven is the supervising producer. Executive producers are Joel Werner, Eric George, and Jessica Radburn. As well as listening to Assassins, you can watch full episodes of the show on YouTube and Spotify. Those videos are shot and edited by Tejas Bhatt. If there's an assassination you think we should cover on the show, please email us, assassins@abc.net.au. I hope to hear from you soon, my friend.